From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Today, we take it for granted that a little box of glass and metal knows how to get us where we want to go. Mutter a few words into your phone in Seattle, and it will guide you, turn by turn, clear across the continent to a friend's driveway in Tallahassee. The story of how technologists folded the world's streets and highways into those little screens is pretty amazing. How they changed the way we see the world, we're still figuring that one out. This hour on Point, the mapping revolution and how it's changed us. You can join us on air or online. Are you old enough to remember pulling out a map, a paper map, arguing over whether to ask someone for directions? Does using Google or iPhone Maps make you feel like you could get anywhere? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll hear Jeff Flake's bold speech to Harvard Law School graduates. But first, joining me now from where else? Palo Alto is Bill Kilday. He's a VP of marketing for the Silicon Valley software company Niantic. His new book is titled Never Lost Again, the Google mapping revolution that sparked new industries and augmented our reality. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So more than 1 billion people use the technology you helped create, from satellite imagery, street maps, panoramic street views, traffic conditions, route planning. I mean, the list goes on. That's quite a mark on the world, Bill.
Indeed it is. That's a daily number that's recently released by Google at its I.O. developer conference recently, that is 1 billion users daily of its Google Maps products.
So this technology, this mapping technology like Google Maps, like Google Earth, it's so integral to our way of life, to how the world operates, really. But the story of how this all started is remarkable. A little cash-strapped tech company that nearly folded when the tech bubble burst. Tell us how it came together initially. What was your role in the mapping story?
Well, the journey for me really starts back in the late 90s with a visit from a good friend of mine, John Hankey. I was living in Austin, Texas at the time, and he called me and he told me that he had a demo that he wanted to show me. And he came over to my house that night, he and another software engineer named Brian McClendon, and they lugged in a server into my living room and set up something that really just floored me, something I'd never seen before. It was essentially what would become 6 years later Google Earth. So starting in the late 90s, there were some technologies that started to come together. Broadband internet, 3D graphics on computers, and on standard consumer PCs. And so they set up the server and they essentially flew down to my house and showed me, you know, my rooftop. And we did the typical thing that people did the first time that they saw Google Maps or Google Earth, which is they went to, you know, where they grew up and they went to their elementary school and they went to their Little League baseball field and they revisited those places. But that's really where it started for me in the late 90s with that visit.
And essentially the technologies you mentioned, the broadband internet, computers, PCs. I mean, what you did is you took GPS technology and combined it with mapping, right? That's at the base, at the core of it, what you did, and that changed everything.
It really is. I mean, the GPS in mobile phone devices was something that started to happen in the late 90s and 2000 as well. So again, it was one of those core technologies that was starting to converge. And that really came out of the basic government mandate that all wireless carriers and handset device manufacturers needed to embed GPS devices in mobile phones. And the reason that happened was because with the advent of mobile phones, you started to have calls into 911 from people who were in distress, who were lost, who were in an accident, who were, you know, in some sort of situation that they needed help, and they didn't know where they were. They weren't tethered to a landline anymore. And so Congress in the late 90s started to require that the wireless carriers and handset manufacturers needed to be able to report to 911 where that caller was. And that ended up being this kind of unexpected fundamental shift in technology, because those GPS devices were there, suddenly it started to enable a whole new core a whole new set of capabilities, a whole new set of services that hadn't existed before.
Here's an example of that. Fifth grade teacher, school teacher Kimberly Haynes and her dog went on a run in Washington State and got lost. 4 days in the woods, she was found because of her cell phone. Here's ABC reporter Janae Norman reporting on her rescue.
They left for a 15-mile run on the Mount Tarif Trail Monday, but never returned. After 4 days of searching under the hot summer sun, rescuers got a GPS signal from her cell phone pinpointing her location.
We were yelling, screaming, and then her dog barked, and then she started yelling as well, and then we found her.
So not just helping with directions, really saving lives here. I mean, you wrote in the beginning of your book, Bill, that when your company was young and fledgling, really, that you were saved by the CIA and CNN. Tell us quickly those two stories.
Well, I think that the company, which was called Keyhole, actually might have started a little early. I mean, we were sort of out in front of where technology was headed. The service was something that really only about 10% of all users could actually get to run on a standard PC at all. That number would double every year, but you didn't have the penetration of broadband internet. You didn't have the computers with rich 3D graphics capabilities. And so for those first 2 or 3 years, we really struggled to find a foothold because just for the simple reason that very few people had the capability of running the software. So while we had a little bit of seed capital, we did essentially run out of cash by the end of 2002. And people started finding other jobs and moving on to other projects. And one thing that we had started to pursue was the local broadcast market for television news reports. Essentially, they would use our software on the air instead of sending a helicopter out to cover a traffic accident or an explosion at a refinery or something like that. They would use our software on the air. Our CEO, John Hanke, managed to get a deal with CNN. And this is in early of 2003, and right before the Iraq War breaks out. And so we eventually get CNN to sign on as a customer. At the last minute, instead of cash, John got them to use our software with our URL on the screen. And so they made that concession. And about a week later, the U.S. invaded Iraq, and they started to use our software, Earthviewer, on the air, basically nonstop. Miles O'Brien was the broadcaster with Wolf Blitzer, and they essentially turned CNN into an infomercial for Keyhole Earthviewer software 24/7 with its hundreds of millions of viewers. And we were suddenly went from a company that had no economic prospects and no visibility to one that had more visibility than we could handle. That was a real turning point for the company.
After a few years after the Gulf War and your technology was introduced, here's a clip from 2015, CNN's Barbara Starr reporting on a drone strike that killed an ISIS propagandist and a hacker as he stood on a street in Raqqa, Syria. He was tracked to that position by his cell phone's GPS.
U.S. spy drones followed and tracked notorious British-born ISIS hacker Junaid Hussein for days before finally launching a Hellfire missile off a drone to kill him as he stood in the street Monday, CNN has learned.
So lots of history there, Bill Kilday. Google acquired your company, Keyhole, in 2004, right? Turned this software into a moonshot mapping effort, called it Google Maps, Google Earth. You were the very first acquisition as a public company for Google. Is that right?
That's right. In October of 2004, Google acquires Keyhole. And that really sort of, begins the next part of the story, next part of the journey in which we had taken this essentially proof of concept software that was being used by tens of thousands and turned it into this mapping moonshot project that ends up being used by billions of users daily.
Well, in the vision, even beyond that, your work, your vision has spurred companies from Yelp to Zillow to OpenTable to Priceline and Uber. I mean, you essentially created a base map upon which entire industries were drawn.
Yes, there were. I mean, that's a sort of a part of the story, I think, that a lot of people don't think about in terms of Google Maps and its impact. There were key engineers at Google, Brett Taylor, Jim Norris. These are guys who have gone on to do amazing things. But they created something called the Google Maps API and essentially allowed these new services to get started, be it Yelp or OpenTable or Zillow, or fast forwarded the advancement of companies like Uber and Lyft and many others. Tinder, anything with a geolocation basically is using Google Maps or some Maps API at its core, so that they don't have to do the heavy lifting of going out and creating from scratch the base map on top of which they draw their new services. So, amazingly, Google, for the first 2 years of the Google Maps API, didn't even charge anything for that at all. So it became sort of an incubator, if you will, of really, incentivizing and making it easy for new companies like that to get started. And it's still being used today by hundreds of thousands of users.
Is it true you have a terrible sense of direction, Bill?
I don't have the best sense of direction. My wife has an incredible sense of direction, so I think I'm even lazier. And with Google Maps and my wife, I rarely have to worry about directions.
We're talking about how maps have gone from a big folded up piece of paper in your glove compartment to a soothing voice beaming directions. 1 billion people using this technology now. You can join the conversation. Tell us how your GPS saved you, got you to the church on time, how your map told you where you parked your car. How did it get you lost? Much more after this break, including your calls. I've got a line of them. Here, we'll get to you after the break. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the story of how mapping changed the world this hour, from cartographers to programmers to anyone with an app. Do you see a mixed blessing here? Do you still have a good sense of direction, or are you totally dependent on your phone? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook and On Point Radio. My guest this hour, Bill Kilday. His new book is titled Never Lost Again, The Google Mapping Revolution That Sparked New Industries and Augmented Our Reality. I have so many calls. I want to get to a few here at the top. Sebastian in Shelby, North Carolina. Hi, Sebastian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My comment is my son has a GPS and all that on his phone, and he's used it for us to go places, and I'm like a caveman staring at it like fire for the first time. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
But you are going to need you for a lot longer than you're going to need a GPS or anything. So my advice to everyone who has GPS would be to use the old brain. Because I'm telling you, when you have it, it's awesome. But when the lights go out, you can't see anymore. And there's never been a system that hasn't gone out or malfunctioned in some way at some point. And at that point, you still have a real life to live. So put the old brain back in action so that when this thing that you're counting on happens to be wrong,
yeah,
you have a chance to be right.
You're ready to go. Sebastian, thank you very much. They're from North Carolina. How about Sean in Sarasota, Florida? Sean, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to call and tell you about a story. In 2006, when I was a senior in high school, I was on my way to take the SAT exam in another town, and I made an illegal U-turn. And so I saw a police officer coming up behind me pretty quick, and I knew I had done something wrong. So I immediately pulled over into his parking spot and took out my big map and laid it on the car in front of me. And he came and tapped on my window, and he let me go after pointing me in the right direction. I don't think that would work with a cell phone nowadays.
No, I doubt it. I doubt pointing to Google Maps would get you out of a ticket. Sean, thank you very much. Let's get one more. Rolanda in Gastonia, North Carolina. Hi, Rolanda.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to comment that I think the combination of the GPS technology with mobile devices is awesome. It gives you the ability to not feel so overwhelmed and lost when you're in unfamiliar situations. And in addition to that, you can always print off your directions just in case your GPS does malfunction when you're out and about. So you have that added tip of security. And you can find your phone, you can find your children, you can find whoever you need to find and whatever you need to find. Mm. So I think it's a win-win all around. Mm.
Rolanda, thank you. Bill Kelday, what was most surprising to you? You hear a few stories there from our listeners about how they use and how they feel about their mapping technology. What was most surprising to you about the application of this technology that you helped create?
Well, I think that I think the technology started being used in ways that we could have never anticipated or expected. And it was essentially this new idea that was put out there into the world. And it was the creativity of the world that started to do wonderful things with it, from environmental uses and discovery to stories of like Saru Brierley, the story of him finding his mother in India and retracing his journey back to his mother, which became the movie
The Lion, right?
The movie The Lion.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
there became this sort of dozens of unexpected uses of the software. One that is highlighted in the book is a story about how the Coast Guard uses Google Earth during the rescue operations in Hurricane Katrina. And that story is one that just made the rounds within Google and I think kind of floored everybody with the notion of our software being used to actually pinpoint people and rescue people in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. That's something that we couldn't have anticipated, that the Coast Guard would actually adopt our software and start using it to save lives was one of those amazing unexpected uses of this great new idea.
Hmm. I want to play this memorable scene from the NBC series The Office. Michael and Dwight, played by Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson, are driving to a meeting in a rented car. Michael's at the wheel, slavishly obeying instructions from the GPS, and hilarity ensues.
Make a right turn.
Wait. No. It means bear right.
No.
Up there.
It said right. It said take a right.
Make a right.
Maybe it's
turn.
A shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's
Look,
a lake
right
there.
I think it knows where it is going.
This is the
lake.
Machine knows.
This is the lake.
Stop yelling at me.
No, it's
Stop
up there.
Yelling.
There's no lake
here. Remain calm. Here we go.
Make a U-turn, if possible.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation at this point. Here with me in the studio is John Huth. He's a particle physicist at Harvard. He was involved in the discovery of Higgs boson, the so-called God particle. But he also became very concerned a few years ago about our dependence on digital mapping and smartphones to find our way. And so he wrote a book called The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. John Huth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jane.
So in your research over the years on traditional navigation, one of the places you've turned to be an especially rich source of information was Iceland. Tell us why that was and what happened to you up there with your GPS.
Let's see. The Norse had this amazing ability to navigate through the North Atlantic, and it's very challenging because it's very foggy there. So they had to figure out ways of holding their paths. I've found that I prefer not to use GPS because it actually confuses me and it makes mistakes. So two years ago, I was at the airport in Keflavik in Iceland, which is about a 45-minute drive from Reykjavik, mm-hmm. the capital.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I think I let my wife and daughter convince me to get a GPS unit. And we programmed in the coordinates of the hotel. I started driving towards Reykjavik. I knew it was a 45-minute drive. And I was expecting to see the ocean on the left-hand side of me because I had a mental image of Reykjavik. And all of a sudden, I saw the ocean on the right-hand side. And this didn't make sense to me. So I pulled the car over, stopped, got out a paper map, realized that the GPS unit was routing me in a funny way. So I just turned it off and used the map to get me to my hotel.
So what are the upsides, the downsides of GPS technology from your research, from your experience?
Well, the upside clearly is that you have right in your hands a map of your environment, and it often helps. The problem, as I see it, is the part of our brain which is wired to do voyages or journeys This kind of thing is something that doesn't get used. And there was a recent study in London of people that navigated through the London streets either using a GPS or using their native abilities. And this part of the brain was completely dark for people that used the GPS and was fully lit up by people who were navigating. The other aspect, which is fairly important and is interesting, is the same part of the brain called the hippocampus is responsible for declarative memory, that is to say the memories that we use. If you call up the name of your favorite high school teacher, for example, that's a declarative memory. And it's also involved in how we plan for the future. So the idea that we just turn off this important part of our brain is a little scary to me.
So you're saying with the GPS, we are essentially ignoring the real world cues that we've always used to get around as humans. We ignore our own internal homing devices, if you will.
Yes, that seems to be correct, and it's borne out by a lot of studies by neuroscientists at this point. The other thing, if you think to what it's like using a GPS, you're getting a very narrow window on the world. You're just seeing what the next turn is, and you aren't getting this large picture view. And the way our brains operate is to have kind of a large picture view of the environment, as if we're on a magic carpet hovering over the environment. And we tend to lose this with GPS.
Mm. Bill Kilday, I'll ask you to respond to that. I know you didn't, think about brain function when you started GPS mapping, but what do you make of the professor's comments here?
Yeah, I could see the point. I mean, I've got a calculator now, and it's true that I'm probably not as good at math in my head anymore as I used to be because I've got this calculator. But I think there is probably a point, which is you have these new technologies, and does it make sense for you to not use the calculator every time that you're wanting to make a calculation? Are you going to lose that muscle memory in your mind or not develop some critical skills that you won't always have that calculator there with you? And so I think maps are probably the same way. It probably does make sense to challenge yourself every once in a while and keep that phone in your pocket and try to find your way home without it, just to see if you can do it.
Sally is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Jane and Bill. This is a fascinating conversation to me. I have a great sense of direction, and I always felt it was because I grew up sitting beside my father in the front of the car reading directions from the road map, and my sister and my mother were in the back because they were car sick. And I really believe that was what gave me this, way of knowing things. But I want to sort of speak to something that John brought up. I was down in Charleston, South Carolina 3 years ago in what was called the storm of the century, and roads were washed out, the interstate was washed out, and I had to get up to Raleigh, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. My daughter had the GPS in the car. We had road maps, and we found with the GPS, because we had to take side roads and back country roads, that we would go a distance and then a bridge would be washed out, and we'd have to back up and detour around. And the GPS wasn't indicating these bridges that were washed out. And I have to say, we got to Raleigh, and I think part of that was because I was a Girl Scout and learned how to navigate. But I love GPS. I think it's wonderful in terms of where you're trying to get somewhere. But I think a map also gives you a sense of a broader picture in terms of where you are.
Sally, thank you. John Heath.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The map will give you a broader picture. It'll give you some options that you might not have with the GPS. And what I even do, I mean, this is going to sound goofy, but I use the sun and wind directions and all sorts of clues as I'm traveling around to maintain a directionality, which you wouldn't get nominally from a GPS. And it just feels like I'm connected to the environment in a way that I wouldn't ordinarily be if I had this thing barking at me, I suppose. And it's not to minimize the utility of these, but we already heard from Bill, it's a good idea to put it away at least periodically to encourage the use of your senses.
So, Bill, are Google and Apple remapping? I mean, how do we keep up constantly with the changing surface of the planet and the changing geography that's going on?
Well, that's a part of the amazing part of the experience that is amazing to me is the scale of the Google mapping team now, and it's certainly a lot bigger than when I was there. There are now upwards of 7,000 people working on that team, and they're processing 25 million changes every single day to Google Maps. In 2012, Google also bought a company called Waze for almost $1 billion that essentially is taking feeds from users that are out in the real world and making that a part of the Google Maps data feed. So whether it be traffic incidents or road closures or other things that have changed about your route, Google Maps is now using that data and that technology to try to keep up with what is a dynamic, ever-changing planet.
Even regardless of those 7,000 people working on that, John Huth, you know, you still have that experience of the highway exit that doesn't exist, or, you know, the time lag that causes you to overshoot, can't quite get there. I mean, there are bugs, not bugs, but there are issues with this, certainly.
Yeah. So here's an interesting exercise for anybody to play along at home. Go to Google Images and type in the words, your GPS is wrong, and you'll get treated to a host of images of road signs where I guess people got annoyed with cars showing up in front of their houses because the information was wrong. Now, this is not to say that maps are infallible either, because maps as well will have errors in it, and I've encountered that. But it's just important not to put blind faith in it.
Here's ABC's Amy Robaugh with her hosts on Good Morning America a year ago, telling the story of a young woman in Kitchener, Ontario, who trusted her GPS too much on a dark, foggy night.
Do not believe everything your GPS tells you. Case in point, a Canadian woman who followed hers right down a boat ramp into Lake Huron. She actually had to roll down her window quickly and was able to climb out of it and swim to shore. It was a dark, foggy night.
Oh, dear. Let's get Cecil in here from Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Cecil.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My use of Google Earth is a little different. I'm a writer. And in a novel I wrote a couple of years ago, part of it took place in Haiti after the earthquake. And I was able to look at the roads, even though I've never been to Haiti, I could find the roads that people had to travel to get out of town to escape to the countryside, and even trails alongside creeks and all. So the scene was very accurate. And then the other part of the story took place in Japan. And I had a student in a college there, and I could get him on his bicycle, and I could see exactly how he got down to the coast and that sort of thing. So it allowed me to add some verisimilitude to stories of places that I've never been.
Cecil, great. Thank you so much. Let's get Michael in here from Burke, South Dakota. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, James.
Hi. Go ahead.
You probably almost covered all the comments that I was going to make, which are that a lot of times you almost have to know something about the area you're in, or the GPS will take you where you don't want to go, whether it's a dangerous area, bad conditions, whatever. And here in South Dakota, we have a lot of times where GPSs will take you to a road that doesn't exist. And a lot of my comments have to do more with the people making the GPSs and the way they program them, that there isn't any way that I'm aware of that any GPS has a learn feature where you can correct it.
Oh, that's interesting. Michael, thank you very much. Bill Kilday, what about that?
Well, it's not wouldn't say a very evident part of the Google Maps interface, but there is a link in almost all Google Maps interfaces that is called Report a Problem, and that is the essentially the funnel for edits and updates to Google Maps, and what goes on behind the scenes there is really kind of an incredible, huge task to try to keep up to date with what is a dynamic, changing planet. But they do maintain that that database of changes basically they clear out all changes every single day, upwards of 25 million changes every single day.
So hold on, Michael. It may be coming. Thanks so much for your call. We're talking about how we find our way in the world now that the miracle of mapping is folded into our daily lives. Does your phone make you feel like a superhero? Can you find your way anywhere? Does it make you feel vulnerable? Where do you think this technology will take us next? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about how GPS satellites and our cell phones came together to change how we see the world. You can join the conversation. Do you have a story about how your phone saved you or harmed you? Do you have a prediction about where this technology can take us tomorrow? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Bill Kilday, author of the new book, Never Lost Again, and John Huth, author of The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. Here's a commercial for a GPS navigation app called Sijic. It promotes itself for its display on our car's windshield.
When driving with Sijic, even a long-distance drive at night can be much safer. Innovative head-up display will project navigation onto your car's windshield, so you'll never have to take your eyes off the road. Enjoy stress-free travel without getting lost.
Let's get another couple calls in here. Tim in Elkridge, Maryland. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane and Bill. It is fair to remember that the United Nations Environment Program gave Bill, John Hanke, and the Keyhole team their first contract in 2001. Not enough money to succeed, but put them on the world stage at the World Summit for Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, South Africa. Mm. Rebecca Moore and millions of others have taken the environmental and earth protection pathway, perhaps an earth-saving tool. So well-deserved success to Bill and to Google Earth team. And what a great, awesome program today, Jane.
Tim, thank you very much. Bill Kilday was one of the first efforts to protect the Earth's environment. I mean, what is he speaking about there specifically?
Well, one of the amazing uses of Google Earth has been the incredible work of Rebecca Moore and the Google Earth Outreach Program, which is essentially using Google Earth as a dashboard for the planet for a variety of environmental causes. In the Google Ocean project being another part of that as well. So the commitment by Google to use this awesome tool for environmental uses has been something that I've been super proud to be a part of, and it continues to amaze. There's not really a commercial reason for it, but it is certainly a lot of amazing things that are happening at Google still using Google Earth and that Google Earth Outreach program.
Thank you very much for the call. John Huth, jump back in here. You tell the story of getting lost in a kayak in the fog out on Cape Cod here, and you wanted to learn to navigate by your own senses, your own devices. Tell us the story quickly.
Okay. Started in the summer of 2003. I was renting a house off the coast of Maine, and I rented a recreational kayak. I was crossing a large embayment. I had a kind of a mental map of where I was. I was a mile across a two-mile crossing, and then all of a sudden, fog started rolling in, and I didn't have any way of finding directions or keeping my bearings, and I fought panic. And I said, okay, which way is the wind blowing? It's from the southeast. Okay, good. Which way is the swell coming? Swell is coming from the southwest. Good. And what else can I hear? I could hear waves crashing on a beach to my northeast. So I was able to use those as kind of a natural compass and find my way around the island, whereas otherwise I might have been gone right out to sea and never seen again. Fast forward another couple months later, Columbus Day weekend, I went out on my recreational kayak again. It was sunny again. I paid attention to the wind direction this time. And Lord knows, the fog rolled in again. And this time, I was just able to find my way using the wind direction as a natural compass. I learned the next day that two young women had gone out at exactly the same time and exactly the same place about a half mile down the beach. They were lost, and they found the bodies of one of the young women the next day, and they never found the body of the other young woman, and I became obsessed and taught myself how to navigate using stars and winds and the sun.
And after that, you began actually teaching a class at Harvard on navigation techniques. What do you tell your students about finding your way around?
Well, we start out with the basics, just counting your paces. A mile is 1,000 paces in Latin. And so you count your paces, you pay attention to where you're going, and this is a technique called dead reckoning. It's the most basic way that you can find your way. Even ants do this. Then we learn how to use a map and a compass, and then they have to memorize the positions of major stars in the sky and where the sun is in the sky. And we have various exercises where they have to go out and use these techniques. And then they forecast weather or learn how to forecast weather using cloud formations and wind directions. And a lot of them report that they start to look at the world differently, as I had after my self-imposed regimen of learning these techniques as well.
Bill Kilday, you would not suggest substituting automation for actual reasoning, even with this fantastic technology that you helped create.
No, I would not. I mean, there's a bit of irony in this as well in terms of this class being taught at Harvard, because the digital mapping revolution could actually be traced all the way back to Harvard to a landscape architecture student named Jack Dangerman in the late 60s in the Graduate School of Design. And they founded a company, Jack and Laura Dangerman, called Esri, which is essentially, you know, the mapping software for everything from crime to land use planning to tax assessor collectors, any sort of digital map that you saw from, you know, 1970 to 2000 was powered by Esri, and it's still a thriving company. And it's interesting that it was started right there at Harvard at the Graduate School of Design.
Let me get another couple calls in here. Matt in Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, good. Go ahead.
So I was just thinking, because I'm very good at navigating and I never have a problem with it. However, my fiance sort of relies on GPS to get everywhere. And I just think it's very interesting that even though people have this map in front of them all the time, I feel like people are sort of losing the ability to read a map because they rely so heavily on just getting the voice being told where to go that they don't really know how to look for it. And it sort of plays to what both of them said. But even though I know how to get pretty much everywhere, I still use my GPS because I use the Waze feature that they were talking about that Google just bought out several years ago. If I'm going somewhere, I use it to check the traffic just to make sure that the route that I know to take is the best one.
Matt, thank you. John Huth, I want to get John back in here. Sorry to cut you off, Matt, but you had an issue with Waze you wanted to tell us about. I thought was very funny during the break.
Somebody suggested that I use Waze, and I used it a couple of times, but then I found myself in a traffic jam, and it directed me off to, I guess, circumvent the jam. And I found myself in a traffic jam on secondary roads, because what was happening was there were so many Waze users that were getting directed along this route. We were basically creating traffic jams in front of private people's houses because it didn't have the ability to realize that it was routing everybody the same way. And I wonder if maybe a clever algorithm writer can figure out a way around that problem.
That's to come, Bill. On that note, Bill Kilday, what's the future here? Give us a glimpse of what's to come with this technology.
Well, I think that, you know, the amazing, you know, effort to sort of keep up to date with the planet and to continually update it and to it's a dynamic place, and to try to make it as current as possible, there's going to be lots of efforts there. In the world of augmented reality, you'll start to see maps at the core of new technologies for sort of the theming of the world around you, in the world of gaming, as an example. So I think that is has maps at its core, those new technologies. And I think mapping will continue to be an area of amazing innovation over the coming years.
Do you think our cities will start to look or be built or designed differently because of this capacity, this capability?
Well, I think to a certain extent they already have. I mean, you think about the impact of Uber and Lyft on traffic patterns and on things like infrastructure for parking, you do start to see that these technologies are having an impact in terms of how many parking lots are built and how many parking spaces are needed for a new condo that's going up, because you know, essentially people are changing their behaviors because these new technologies exist.
John Huth, wrap us up here. How do you see this capability changing us as individuals and as a society?
Well, I think it can change us in the way we view information and our sources. I think we just have to be careful that we don't abandon our native capabilities and be aware that when you get to a fine enough grain level, technology will never be able to sort of conquer sort of the smallest scale issues that we're looking at. But I think getting more information and being able to use it judiciously is always a good thing. You just have to know how to be judicious about it.
How do you see, Bill Kilday, this technology changing us as individuals and as a society?
Well, I like to think that it already has, in terms of it's changed the way that the world has navigates its way and makes its way through the world. I'm happy to have been a part of it.
Well, great discussion here and terrific calls. Thank you very much to Bill Kilday, Vice President of Marketing for the Silicon Valley software company Niantic. His new book is Never Lost Again, The Googling Mapping Revolution That Sparked New Industries and Augmented Our Reality. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
And John Huth, particle physicist at Harvard and author of The Lost Art of Finding Our Way.
Thank you.
Great stories and great to have you, John. Thank you.
Thanks.
In a moment, Republican Senator Jeff Flake's commencement address at Harvard Law School. We'll have that next. This is On Point. Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake captured the national spotlight earlier this year when he delivered a strong rebuke against President Trump on the Senate floor. Last Wednesday, Flake once again abandoned subtlety during a 26-minute commencement address to graduates at Harvard Law School. His speech painted a picture of a nation in dark times and in need of bold defenders of democracy willing to stand strong for their beliefs.
Not to be unpleasant, but I do bring news from our nation's capital. First, the good news. Your national leadership is, well, not good at all. Our presidency has been debased by a figure who seemingly has a bottomless appetite for destruction and division, and only a passing familiarity with how the Constitution works. And our Article I branch of government, the Congress, that's me, is utterly supine in the face of the moral vandalism that flows from the White House daily. I do not think that the founders could have anticipated that the beauty of their invention might someday founder on the rocks of reality television, and that Congress would be such willing accomplices to this calamity. Our most ardent enemies doing their worst, and they are doing their worst, couldn't hurt us more than we are hurting ourselves. Now you might reasonably ask, where's the good news in that? Well, simply put, we may have hit bottom. And that's also the bad news. In a rare convergence, the good news and the bad news are the same. Our leadership is not good, but it probably can't get much worse. This is it, if you've been wondering what the bottom looks like. This is what it looks like when you stress test all of the institutions that undergird our constitutional democracy at the same time. You could say that we are witnesses to history, and if it were possible to divorce ourselves from the obvious tragedy of this debacle, I suppose it might even be interesting. The same way some diseases are interesting to medical researchers. But this is an experience that we could and should have avoided. Getting to this state of distress did not naturally occur. Rather, it was thoroughly man-made. This disease of our polity is far too serious not to be recognized for what it is. The damage it threatens to do to our vital organs is far too great for us to carry on as if all is well. All is not well. We have a sickness of the spirit. To complete the medical metaphor, you might say that we're now in critical condition. How did we arrive at such a moment of great peril, wherein the President of the United States publicly threatens, on Fox and Friends, historians will note, to interfere in the administration of justice, and seems to think that the office confers on him the ability to decide who and what gets investigated and who and what does not. And just this week, the President, offering an outlandish rationale, ordered an investigation into the investigation of the Russian attack on our electoral process. Not to defend the country against future attacks, mind you, but to defend himself. Obviously, ordering investigations is not a legitimate use of presidential power. I pick this egregious example of recent presidential conduct not because it is rare in terms of the president's body of work, but because it so perfectly represents what we have tragically grown accustomed to in the past year and a half. Who would have thought that we would ever see encouragement coming from the White House for chants at rallies calling for the jailing of a defeated political opponent? When you don't even know what the limits of presidential power are, you might not even care when you're abusing that power. How did this happen to us? And what might we learn from it? How did we get swept up in this global resurgence of the authoritarian impulse, which has democracies teetering on the brink, strongmen placing themselves above the law, and in our own country, a leader who reveres some of the most loathsome enemies of democracy in our time? Have we really grown tired of democracy? Are we watching its passing, cheered on by the America First crowd, even as we cast aside global institutions that have fostered freedom and peace for more than a half century?
That is Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake speaking to Harvard Law School graduates last week. For a video and transcript of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, Jeremy Rolosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, life lessons from men after the devastating deaths of their wives. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.